You're listening to the AHDB podcast, practical know-how to help your farm business. It's Grain Market Outlook Week. Because of government restrictions, we're not able to hold our annual conference this year, so we've dedicated the last few days to all things grain markets. I'm David Udall, head of AHDB's Arable Market Specialists. And in this edition of the Cereals and Oilseeds podcast, we've lined up some fantastic guests from far-flung regions of the world to discuss global issues facing grain markets at the moment. So stay tuned to hear from Robert Johansson, Chief Economist at the US Department of Agriculture. He'll be discussing how the US is using data to improve market awareness and what the big global drivers are. Ben Buckner, Chief Grain Analyst at AgResource in the US, will look at the details of the US maize and soybean markets and what the prospects are for South American crops. Andrew Whitelaw of Thomas Elder Markets, based in Australia, will be discussing the outlook for Aussie barley and oilseed rape and how this will affect the UK and our future trading arrangements. And Andrei Sizov, Managing Director of Sovicon, will be discussing the important aspects of the Russian wheat market and its impact on global prices. At the end of the episode, I'll also provide some further information. So we're going to start talking to Robert Johansson, Chief Economist at the US Department of Agriculture. We're joined now by Robert Johansson, the Chief Economist from the US Department of Agriculture. Robert, thank you so much for joining us on our podcast to talk about global markets and global information. It's a real valuable thing to have you on and spare your time. Do you want to just sort of briefly introduce kind of what your role is at the USDA and sort of where you fit in with the world?
Oh, thanks a lot, David. It's a pleasure to join you today. Talk about a lot of issues that are near and dear to my heart. I'm a chief economist here at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And in my office of the chief economist, we have the World Agricultural Outlook Board, who are responsible for providing each month an estimate of the world ag supply and demand estimates. Your readers may know that as the WASD. So we pull together our best estimates each month of global supply and demand for the major commodities, U.S. production of livestock and poultry and dairy as well. So that's a big chunk of what we do here in the Office of the Chief Economist. We also are responsible for doing a lot of trade support, domestic policy support for the secretary. We this year have been very busy responding to the coronavirus, and our office was integral to developing the coronavirus food assistance programs for helping producers adjust to a lot of the disrupted markets that not only our producers, but of course, producers in the UK as well as globally have been facing. So we do a lot of that kind of work as well. We're also involved with any regulatory actions that the US Department of Agriculture takes. We're responsible for making sure that the costs and benefits are fully explained to the public and in a regulatory impact assessment. So those are some of the things that we work on here. I've been with the department going back to 2001. I have not always been in this role. I've been in this role for the last 5 years now. You know, with this time of year, everybody is curious about whether people's positions change, what have you, with the elections. Our office is entirely career staff. So we're here no matter who the administration is, and our job is to support the administration's initiatives. And so again, pleasure to be with you and happy to talk about the current global setup for production and some of the other interesting questions that you've got lined up.
Great. Cheers, Rob. Thank you. So I guess there's a couple of interesting points there that you raised, and something I'd like to sort of maybe start on is around that question of that sort of big global data and the information that you're reporting on. And, you know, the WASD, as you said, is one of the sort of the key integral points of information for the global agricultural marketplace. And I think the last few months with coronavirus and the impacts on markets has shown that, you know, there is a real need for independent, transparent market information so that people know what's going on. But, you know, what do you think sort of for some of the challenges and opportunities that you face as the USDA producing these reports and information and collecting that data? Is there any, you know, new technology or new ways that you're looking to collect data that you think would make it not necessarily more accurate, but just more relevant and a more truthful, clearer picture?
Yeah. That's a great question. Each year we're challenged both by our own producers as well as producers globally about our estimates. Oftentimes, if we put out an estimate that seems too bearish or too bullish, somebody is going to come back and ask us, you know, why don't we improve our information gathering to get a more, accurate estimate. But we, as you point out, we try and do our best job objectively, and it does provide a good benchmark for other groups around the globe that sort of use our estimates as a stepping off point for doing their own estimates, whether that's on a more refined time period. So again, as I mentioned, we just do monthly. Some groups do weekly or even daily in terms of a specific commodity, perhaps, or a specific region. So again, we sort of start, you know, each month, and then groups will use those estimates moving forward through the month. We'll put out another estimate and everybody will recalibrate and so on and so forth. I'll just point out that in addition to the WASD, we also do the baseline. So we're in the middle of our baseline process now, where we estimate out 10 years. So again, 10 years out is obviously a big question mark for a lot of these supply and demand estimates. But certainly next year's forecast will be important for a lot of policymaking, thinking about what producers are expecting to see in terms of prices. And producers will adjust based on that and based on weather as well. Of course, another component of that, as you know, is markets. And markets provide the price signals that help producers actually manage their risk as well as manage their operations as efficiently as they can. The markets also rely on the WASD every month to try and set the new sort of equilibrium price for the commodities that we cover, at least. Our work is important for that as well. So you asked about new technology. So we're always trying to incorporate new technology. The easy one to sort of point at right now is sort of satellite information, remote sensing. That's always improving as we see new data sources coming in, whether that's from the European space exploration and sensing information that's provided through some of those European satellites, but also the US satellites and new information that we're getting from those. And those are, you know, primarily publicly, all publicly available data sources. We pull those in and combine them with, I guess, what I would say is our comparative advantage, which is our human information that we have from around the world. Certainly in the United States, we base almost all of our estimates, certainly around this time of year when harvesting is occurring and when producers are actually seeing what's coming off the field, on survey work. Survey work is expensive, but it does provide the most statistical, reliable estimates that you can get. Obviously, in a lot of countries such as China, for example, surveys are very, very expensive, right? You have lots more producers. Putting that number of enumerators out in the field to gather that information is extremely expensive. So, satellite information there does make a lot of sense. We always encourage countries, when they're developing their own baselines to and their own quarterly forecast, for example, a lot of countries will do a quarterly, to supplement that with survey work as well, if they can. And we partner with them and show them how we do it here in the United States, whether that's in person, in phone, in mail, or online survey work. And to be frank, in this sort of era of COVID, we've moved a lot of much away from obviously in-person survey work that we might've done in previous years to almost primarily mail-in or phone or online surveys. The online survey is the cheapest. So obviously we get more results. If we can get more producers to respond to online surveys, of course, producers are tired of us asking them questions. So a lot of times one of the complaints we'll get is, the survey work doesn't always reflect situation because producers are sort of not taking it as seriously as we would certainly like them to. So we do supplement with a lot. You know, we have our own folks that go out and take surveys this time of year in particular. We'll go out and sample corn and soybean fields to estimate the number of years per stalk and the weight of the pods on the soybean plants to get a more refined estimate that way. And we do combine it, of course, with the remote sensing data as well. That's for the US. So of course we get a very good picture of U.S. production. Globally, we have our offices spread around the globe. U.S. Foreign Ag Service has a lot of very talented, very experienced folks in those offices that are providing us with their observations of whether it's UK wheat or India rice or what have you. They're out in the field, driving around, taking a look at it, sort of giving us a gut check on what their governments are also reporting. And we use that information, again, combined with the remote sensing data to and the weather data to sort of put us in the right sort of in the right neighborhood of a good estimate. Then again, if we'll see actual trade data and price data that we can again use to fine tune that. So let me just say a couple things that are coming up that I think would be interesting to talk about. You know, we are seeing U.S. farmers purchase more on-farm storage. We've had some a couple of years now where whether it's the trade issues that we've had with some of our major trading partners, the EU, China, India, Canada, Mexico back in 2018, and then more recently, all of this COVID stuff that's going on, producers do see value in putting more on-farm storage on their operations. Usually we have very good reporting from the commercial elevators in terms of their stocks. So getting a good stock number when you have more on-farm storage is going to be an issue that we're going to be working towards finding solutions to. Measuring those stocks obviously has really big implications for prices. And so that's not a remote sensing issue. It's going to be a survey issue. So again, finding ways to get producers to respond, you know, as accurately as they can hopefully it's up to us as part of government to find out a way to make those surveys simpler, more streamlined, less burdensome on the producer. And sort of those are, I guess, not the really techie, interesting things to talk about right now, but certainly, rolling up our sleeves and getting good information is what we're all about. And we're going to put money behind doing that.
So that's a really interesting point, because from a UK perspective at the moment, that's actually one of the big problems that we've had over the last few weeks, is that we have an on-farm stock survey at the end of June. For wheat and barley predominantly. And one of the issues that we've had is because of the lower number of people that responded to that and the lower stocks that we had, it's actually pulled out a bit of an erroneous figure that we're not quite sure about. And that then gets factored into the balance sheet, and therefore your ending stock for one season gets carried over into the next as your opening stock, and your problem carries on. So no, it's really interesting to hear that there isn't necessarily a magic bullet, is there? Really what you need is as many people as possible to put as much accurate information in. And you know, the more accurate information that you put into that system, the better it will come out at the other end. And it's a challenge that we face in the UK at the moment, that issue of how to collect accurate stock data.
Yeah, you know, and I've thought about a lot of different ways to motivate producers on this. It comes down to, at some point in time, and we've seen it this year and certainly last year as well, producers are facing pretty tight times, pretty hard situations with respect to COVID or with respect to the trade situation for a lot of our producers. And we need, as part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, it's our job to think of ways to provide, relief or assistance to help producers with those challenges. So when we're setting up a program and if we don't have the most accurate data available, it's not as easy to sort of target that relief where it's, it should be going. So I always talk to producers and say, remember, when that hurricane hit, or when we had that drought, or when, we were putting together a trade mitigation program, your information that you're sending to us is what we're using to develop those programs in a way that's most helpful to you. And if we don't have that information, the program may be, off targeted. It may not go to where it's needed the most. So again, it is difficult to motivate, because ultimately, farmers are busy people and they are trying to make ends meet wherever they can. And carving out time to sit down and fill out a survey is probably pretty low on their priority list. So again, making it easy to fill out, whether it's repopulating with last year's information or not asking them questions we really don't need is on us to make sure that it's simple and streamlined. And then it's on the producers to give us their best information available to help us, you know, with our job of making programs targeted to where it's, they're needed the most.
The process that we go through in the next few weeks, where we're going to review our stock figures and review the methodology, if we find the magic bullet and we find the perfect way to do it, don't worry, you'll be top of my list. I'll come and let you know.
Excellent. Excellent. We'll have to have a follow-up on this then.
That'd yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, David. I'll write that down. David's got a magic bullet.
David's got a magic bullet. It will fix everything you need about agricultural market information. I just need to go and think what it is and then we'll be all right.
You know, I probably have been familiar. We've been working with the UK on this issue, as well as the EU and other countries as part of the, you know, the OECD, FAO, AMIS project.
Yeah.
You know, that's all about, that's only four commodities, right? So maize, soybeans, rice, and wheat. But we're, you know, again, have been working since the last food price spike going back to 2010, 2011, trying to make sure that countries know what, you know, production and stocks are so that they don't put in place sort of unhelpful policies such as export restrictions, et cetera. We did see actually some of that happening with COVID here. Some countries restricting rice exports and some wheat exports as well. But fortunately, those were short-lived and we're in a larger production regime right now. We've got, you know, generally wheat production up globally, right, to record levels. Looking at what we have for EU right now, up a little bit from last month, but significantly down from last year, as you know better than I do. And US production, again, slightly down from last year. But overall, global production up. Wheat prices actually in the US are up as well, which is a good thing for our producers. But you know, and it has been a rebound from last year. 2019 was a tough year, yep. You know, particularly in the U.S. We had a lot of acres that went unplanted just because of bad, you know, bad spring, too wet, too cold. Producers couldn't get out there. They got out there late. It was, you know, low yielding crops overall. So this year we're bouncing back, but overall, you know, higher production globally, sort of, I guess I would say, up until the last month or so, prices had been pretty low, I would say globally, but we've seen some strengthening. We've seen, you know, some reduction in our crop size for corn in particular and soybeans as well. So we've seen some pretty strong price signals right now for corn and soybeans, somewhat yeah. related to China bouncing back, but we can get into the sort of global COVID recovery. And I'm sure you've got a question on that coming up.
Yeah, well, that was kind of where I was going to go really, because, you know, I look at the market right now and like the trader in me just kind of thinks I really want to sell that market. You know, it kind of looks like it's there to be sold, but it's almost as if this news just keeps on coming and coming. And I think especially from a soybean and corn point of view and the trade that's going on, it seems as if a lot of that US trade is sort of helping to, you know, keep the market a little bit supported and just sort of keep it simmering along and keeping a lot of interest in it. And then, you know, you add that into the La Nina weather that we're going to be getting through the Northern Hemisphere winter and Southern Hemisphere summer and the impact that that could have. And it kind of feels as if, you know, this market in general, it looks as if it could stay supported for a while. There's still a lot of weather uncertainty around there. And I think, you know, a phrase that we've been using quite a lot is the market seems very nervous at the moment about this information. It seems very nervous and very, very much that it reacts very quickly and maybe disproportionately, but still very quick to react to the weather information that comes in.
Yeah. Yeah. Just before we move off of wheat, though, I will note, you know, what a great crop that Russia's having this year. So yeah. They're bringing in a lot of crop. That's boosting overall supplies, you know, 83 million tons right now is our latest estimate. That's up 5 million tons from last month alone, almost 10 million tons up from last year. So they're going to be trading a lot. But as you mentioned, certainly with corn and beans right now, there is a lot of volatility in the market. Certainly China's coming, forward with a lot more, we had negotiated obviously this phase one agreement back in January that had sort of been moving forward slowly on the, at least on the purchase side, but we had seen, you know, obviously continued negotiations and agreements moving forward on some of the trade. I would say the sanitary, phytosanitary agreements that we were a part of that as well, and some of the other trade facilitating agreements between the US and China. But now the purchases are really picking up. So that is providing some support to the markets, the fact that we are exporting a good amount. We, and as I mentioned, the weather is also affecting, you know, the crop here in the US. You know, we did bring down our corn yield as well as our harvested acres. We've had some weather events, particularly in some large producing regions such as Iowa. Had a big derecho, was it's a big windstorm that knocked down a lot of the corn stalks and making harvest difficult, obviously lowering our yield estimates there substantially for that state. But overall, still looking at a pretty healthy 14.7 billion bushel harvest in the U.S. We were above, you know, 15 billion bushels at the beginning of the year. We've been bringing it down a little bit. That has been providing support. I would say that the market is seeing a lot of uncertainty, as you mentioned, and that's primarily tied to how quickly a lot of these economies recover from COVID. Yeah. How, you know, obviously what drives a lot of, you know, feed grain as well as oilseed demand is going to be the ability of these developing and emerging economy households moving into the middle class, buying a lot more meat. And as that, you know, our expectations of that rise or fall, that's going to drive a lot of this expectation about feed grain and soybean demand. Now, of course, at the beginning of the year, we had pretty healthy expectations for global economic growth. That was completely, you know, washed away with COVID. Had a huge, obviously, recessionary trends across the globe. The United States, obviously, included that. At least expectations are for 2021 to recover, right? So we're all expecting. You know, and the Chinese economy has come back, and they're, you know, buying again. You know. I would say the economic recovery has not been universally even, which is obviously expected. Each country is going to be different. The U.S. is still has, you know, at least judged by unemployment, has recovered, you know, about 50% from where we were at the lowest point in terms of unemployed Americans looking for work. So we have seen recovery. We're expecting 2021 to continue that recovery. Obviously, that's not really per se affecting our production, but it's just an indication that global economic recovery to COVID is not going to be identical from country to country. So we're looking for good, if we get good Asian recovery, good, you know, Middle East and African recovery, we're going to be able to sell, continue to see those, that demand increase from households getting, you know, higher per capita economic, you know, purchasing power, essentially. And that's what we're hoping for. We're going to see a recovery. Just, I think the markets don't know how quickly that's going to happen and to what extent it's going to happen.
Yeah, it's definitely an uncertain time, and that's the theme that we've got. Well, I think that's all the time that we've got for today, Robert. But thank you so much for taking part, Robert Johansson, Chief Economist at the USDA. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I promise when we do figure the magic bullet, as I said, top of the list, straight to you.
Great questions, David. Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure chatting, and look forward to our next time.
All right. Cheers, Rob. Now we move on to talking to Ben Buckner, Chief Grain Analyst at AgResource, looking at what's happening in the US and how South America will affect global markets going forwards. So we're now joined by Chief Grain Analyst from AgResource Company in the US, Ben Buckner. Thank you, Ben, for joining us today. And just before we sort of started recording, we were talking quickly about how you'd, as a company and as an analyst, you'd changed your view of grain markets over the last few months from going from a very bearish perspective in the summer to more of a bullish perspective now. So yeah, do you want to sort of talk through that in terms of, you know, where you think the market could go from here? Are we going to stay bullish, or do you think there's more changes to come?
Yeah, sure. Well, first, David, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast. But yeah, it's changed dramatically, and clearly prices are up. So that's not any kind of insightful forecast. But the biggest difference is because know, the U.S. crops have gotten so much smaller than previously thought. You know, I think we've lost 30 million tons of U.S. corn supply just in each USDA report that's been out since June, really, because China has bought a lot more corn, soybeans, and even wheat than we thought. Because we're dealing with drought in Russia, smaller wheat crops this year in parts of the Black Sea in Europe. All of a sudden, the thinking has changed from the market's buying price that encourages consumption to now, does the market need to find a price that slows consumption down? So that is a big 180 for a lot of different reasons. And so, you know, our thinking too is since we're having so much less supply at the end of this year, you know, those ending stocks become beginning stocks for the 2021 year. And so if we're starting out with less, there's a much heavier burden on weather patterns and dealing with climate change. It doesn't seem like we've had a normal weather pattern in any major exporting country for a long time. So, you know, to put this kind of in perspective, the soybean market, we think, will be the most exciting in 2021. And that is because, you know, even adding 7 million acres in the U.S., you know, let's assume that the U.S. farmer plants 90 million acres of soybeans. Ending stocks will still be 300 million bushels, and that's about 28 days of use. And that's the best case scenarios. So if we were to lose any supply here or in South America, then all of a sudden, like 2012, and so the first time since then, we're talking about supply rationing. And so not only has the, you know, our outlook shifted from bearish to, you know, bullish, with a close eye on weather, but it's, the structure has changed. You know, we need to slow demand down. And so that's kind of where our heads are at the moment. And so now we need perfect South American weather, which in that growing season really will start for the most part this week.
Yeah. So I suppose you're saying there from like a Chinese point of view, that the big surprise over the last couple of months has been the amount of soybeans and corn that they've been buying from the US. And like you kind of mentioning there, you would expect that when we get into the new year, those purchases would start to shift down to South America, and you're going to have more Brazilian corn and soybeans that are going out, and Argentina will be exporting a lot more soybean meal and oil. From a South America point of view, they're obviously going into that La Nina phase, and we've seen that, you know, it can be detrimental to production down there. So it does kind of feel as if that, you know, supportive sentiment, it might not be sort of rampantly outright bullish, but it does kind of feel that nervousness about the market is going to continue even into, you know, March, April next year, because people will be very nervous around the size of that South American crop, and that Chinese demand looks continuous, really.
Yeah, and that's very well said, David. I think nervousness is the right phrase to use there. Especially now, it does seem like Chinese demand growth for a lot of things, but let's stay focused on soybeans, is back. And so what that means is, you know, they're going to buy 100 million tons from all origins this year. And you can add 3 to 5 million tons to that every year in perpetuity at this point. And already the Brazilian soybean crop is delayed in terms of planting. Just, it's been too dry, and that's not a major issue, but they no longer have the buffer stocks. So we've had to raise our soybean export forecast even more because there will not be beans available in Brazil in January, and we think the first half of February. So all of a sudden, the U.S. soybean export program is getting extended by 45 days. So that adds to this problem of tight stocks. And then the La Nina you mentioned, it's very concerning. And all we know at this early date is that 7 of 10 years, you know, over the last couple of decades, when you have had La Nina present in January, drought in Argentina has been devastating. You know, yields, corn and soybeans have been 15 to 25% below trend. So you can lose 10 million tons of beans and 10 million tons of corn pretty easily. So 3 of those 10 years, everything's fine, but it's just not often in this business you get those kind of odds. And so instead of assuming we get these South American soybean and soybean product supplies, it's very dicey at the moment, especially given South America is dry at the moment. I mean, Brazilian rainfall is very seasonal, but it's been slow to develop. It has this sort of long-term soil moisture deficits that probably won't be solved by one or two rain events.
So, I mean, you know, sort of playing this out further into 2021, say we have that La Nina that forms and it carries on through into January, February, and you're seeing, you know, that would lead to a pretty hefty spike in, you know, Chicago soybean futures as we're kind of coming out of the winter. the Northern Hemisphere winter. Do you think that would have any impact on US farmer planting intentions for the next crop for 21? Can they switch more area to beans, or are they pretty, you know, is that area switch pretty much locked in and not able to change around anymore?
I think as a whole, yeah, the switch can happen pretty easily. And those planting decisions are being made probably now. You know, they can be adjusted for the next probably 2 months, the latest. But yeah, I think that's generally the idea. The issue that we have is the new crop soybean to corn ratio is not all that exciting. So, you know, the spot soybean market has been where all the excitement is because the market needs those beans immediately because of this large export program. But it's not really showing up in the back end of the market. So given today's relationships, it's not guaranteed that we plant that many more acres of soybeans. And so that should be one of the goals of the markets looking beyond the next couple of weeks, I think, is encouraging the U.S. farmer and even South American farmer, it's not too late to just maximize soybean area.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think commodity markets and especially agricultural commodity markets, they're one of those, you know, great markets around the world where it is a real sort of true playing out of supply and demand economics. And the price is the true sort of indicator of what the market requires. And you can definitely see, you know, more of a supportive level towards corn values and towards soybean values as we go into the new year. And it's interesting from a, you know, from a UK perspective, because, you know, something that we've spoken about before is how those, you know, impacts around the world translate back to your domestic market. And, you know, it's something that we see in the UK that, you know, more and more we need to be looking further afield, especially with, you know, Brexit and new trade deals and that. And that's something you see in the US as well, isn't it? That you've still got US farmers that, you know, are probably more concentrating on what's happening at the elevator down the road. And we need to spend more time at the moment, especially looking at what's happening with South America and what the weather patterns are over the coming months.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And for us, you know, the US clients, it's so hard to hear how well the producer is doing in Brazil and Argentina and Russia, in some extent, you know, Canada and Australia, you know, just these massive profit margins. And so I know it's frustrating to hear if you're a farmer in the UK or the US, but, you know, to ignore that, I think, is more dangerous. So it's a lot of reasons. It's currency, it's labor costs. It's finding out that land is pretty productive. But the very simple way to think about this is, you know, if you are a farmer in the US or UK is, you know, 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, there were two exporters of soybeans and maybe 1.5 exporters of corn. Now there are 6 exporters of corn and 3.5 exporters of soybeans. You know, the Black Sea is sort of, you know, expanding its footprint on that market. So just knowing that is, I think, very important. So, you know, the U.S. corn farmer is now one of 6 countries that importers can buy from. And we have seen just in the last 3 years, it's very easy to quantify the markets that buy simply on price. We've lost, the U.S. has lost half of its South Korean corn business in 2 years, simply because the U.S. was too expensive relative to South America. So I know it is hard to think about that in terms of these other markets doing so much better on a production standpoint, but you have to recognize that if you're going to be successful in the next couple of decades.
Ben, I think that's a great place to finish there, just to say that the key thing for not only UK farmers, but all farmers around the world is to take that global perspective, because that's really going to be the thing that drives price. So Ben Buckner, Chief Grain Analyst at AgResource in the US, thank you for your time. Thank you for taking part. And thank you for giving us your view on what's happening on the world market at the moment.
David, thank you so much for having me. It's very, very much a pleasure.
Discover your farm's business strengths and weaknesses with AHDB FarmBench. Get started at ahdb.org.uk/farmbench.
Moving to the Southern Hemisphere, we'll now talk to Andrew Whitelaw of Thomas Elder Markets, looking at what's happening in Australia and how their barley and oilseed rape crops will affect the UK over the coming months. So we're now joined on the AHDB Grain Market Outlook podcast by Andrew Whitelaw. Andrew, do you want to introduce yourself and what you do?
Hi, David. I'm mainly a grains analyst for a company called Thomas Elder Markets. which is based in Australia. I've got a bit of a tang in my accent because clearly I'm Scottish originally, but you got me on to be the resident voice on Australian agriculture, which is probably a little bit unusual.
I think there must be some kind of joke in there, mustn't there, about an Englishman talking to a Scotsman about Australia. There's got to be something there we could try and find.
Well, I do know another guy in Australia who's in the grains industry who's Irish, so we could probably get him along next time.
Cool. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for sparing the time. I think one of the kind of couple of the key things that we wanted to talk about today really was, I suppose, from an Australian point of view, with the changes to the crops this year in terms of better production, and then, you know, the impact that's going to have on exports. But predominantly from a barley and then a canola point of view, affecting the import requirement for oilseed rape into both the UK and EU. We'll start with barley, if that's all right, and sort of what the outlook for that crop is in Australia at the moment.
Yes. At the moment, the barley crop is looking fantastic for the most part. Parts of Western Australia aren't looking too great, but overall, we are looking at a pretty big crop. Definitely, we're on track to be the second largest barley crop on record. Like, I don't think we'll hit the record, which is 2016 was just too big, but it's going to be good. And after 2 years of pretty much constant drought, it's going to be a lifesaver. But as you may know, David, Australia has had its concerns with or issues with barley, in that China was our biggest market for feed barley for the last, well, since 2016.
Yeah.
And whether it's politics or whether it's legitimate, we were investigated for dumping barley on China during 2016, which again, they're saying that the prices were too low. The reality is that nobody wants to sell something too low. And it was just the fact that we had shed loads of barley that had to go. So it was supply and demand makes it cheaper. In the end, back in May, we were hit with an 80.5% tariff on all barley that goes into China. Well, there were some sneaky little loopholes in that there was special economic zones where you could import some barley,
okay,
and then process it in it, and then it goes onwards to China, and it didn't attract tariffs, and that's what was happening. And then China decided to start saying that they had phytosanitary issues with cargoes,
and so that think, loophole closed.
Well, the loophole's still there, but I think you'd be a very brave person to continue to export barley to China. But saying that, there has been cargoes going. 30,000 tons in August, which would have been affected by the tariff, which is unusual because it would be the most expensive barley in the world when you include a tariff. But look, the prices at the moment, if you're an Australian farmer, are actually, they're low compared to the last couple of years because our prices were inflated by drought. But if we look at the sort of historical 10-year pricing, it's sort of around about the average price. It's like a decile five. So if we combine sort of decile five prices with decile nine yields,
yeah,
it's not too bad. But we are probably seeing probably something that you don't see in the UK. A lot of people are planning on long-term storage of barley by digging holes in the ground. But we've seen it here where it's stayed for 25 years with no real drop in quality. So there could be, like, we know definitely there's, you can't hire an excavator in parts of the country because they're hired out digging trenches, you know, with 600-700 tons. It's really sort of fascinating. And for a lot of these farmers, it's a good drought hedge for the next drought. You know, if you've got 600 tons of barley, you know, that's going to feed sheep for quite a few months.
Yeah.
But look, we are starting to price into, you know, Saudi Arabia, you know, we've got new markets in Thailand and all throughout Southeast Asia. But you probably couldn't have picked a worse year to remove our biggest customer.
Yeah.
And that is going to be an issue. There's no denying that.
And I suppose that's where it comes from a UK point of view, because we've got, you know, a barley crop this year that's over 8 million tons. And we're probably going to end up with a a lower amount being used in malting. Only yesterday it was announced from a Scottish point of view that they're going to be closing all the pubs and restaurants in central Scotland, as I'm sure you know. And so that's obviously going to be an issue.
I've seen the Facebook updates from angry friends and family, you know.
I was going to say, so you've got no reason to come home anytime soon.
No, there's no point now. But I guess that's the thing, that you're gonna have an exportable surplus of barley, and I guess that's going to be an issue if you guys don't get some sort of preferential deal with the EU come the 1st of January.
Yeah.
So are we going to be competing with you into North Africa and Saudi?
Well, yeah, pretty much. I think that's what it's going to be, because we've got probably somewhere in the range of at least 1.5 million tons, if not more, of barley that we're going to need to export, probably closer to 2 million tons. You know, this past season, we've done vessels into North Africa and Saudi, and we're going to have to do that again. And like you say, if we lose that European market, you know, a large tariff to go into that from the 1st of January onwards, then the only thing we've got to do is switch into North Africa. But the issue that we've got that you guys don't is the moisture point of view and on the quality specs. And also, you know, we're not really, as a country, cut out to do regular 25, 30, 60,000 ton vessels. Whereas Australian shipping is just, you know, based around Panamax and Handamax size, rather than, you know, you're not shipping a 4,000 ton coaster over to Thailand. Yeah. Like, to Spain.
No, it's going to be a struggle to get it out of Portsmouth or Immingham at that level.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the barley thing, the big issue we had is that barley's been a really good gross margin crop for a lot of farmers. And so in a lot of cases, it's been more profitable to grow barley than wheat because it yields better and the prices have been pretty good the last couple of years. And so the announcement from China came sort of mid-sowing, which meant that it was very hard to change to wheat or anything else at that late stage.
Yeah.
And so that there was a lot of area to barley, which has really sort of exacerbated the issue. And we know farmers that have gone wall to wall with barley this year and haven't grown an acre of wheat. So
it's definitely going to be a lot around whichever way we look at it, isn't it, really? And I think that's what we look from our point of view in the UK. We've currently got barley prices that are at a 40, 45 pound discount to feed wheat, which is massive. And, you know, they're going to have to stay there by the sounds of it to find an export market and then compete with what you guys have got in Australia coming over into the sort of North Africa and Middle East markets.
It's going to be a challenge. We'll have to fight it out on the seas.
Yeah. So I suppose for the opposite side, if we're having a fight over barley, we're on the other side of it, we're then probably flipping completely going, all right, we don't really want to have a fight over barley, but can we have your oilseed rape, please? And can we have your canola? Because that's kind of the opposite side from a European scale.
Yeah, and that's going to be, because we imported barley into the UK in 2017 or 2018 into Liverpool. And it's still a rare occurrence. I got messages from old colleagues back in the UK who said, oh, who's bringing this in? And I was like, no idea. I think it turned out to be GrainCorp. But we're looking this year about 3.5 million tons of canola. Last year, we're talking 2.3 million tons. So substantial increase. And that puts a very large crop.
Yeah.
And to give you an example, like we've got, Australia is not just one country in effect. You've got the Western Australia, which is completely export dominated on canola. And that already is pricing into Europe quite well. There's demand in Western Australia will produce something like 1.5 million tons of canola. Domestically, the demand in Western Australia is about 40,000 tons. So it's not
so
going to
get a bit of a surplus.
There. So it's all going to go there and it's efficient and it just goes. Although about 30% of that will be GM, non-GM. But when we look at the East Coast, you know, we've got, you know, Victoria and New South Wales, which are the two sort of second largest sort of growers. And if you combine them, we're talking like a 1.5 to 1.7 million ton crop. Again, with their demand, theirs is a lot higher. Let's call it, for argument's sake, about 1 million tons. So then you've got really 700,000, maybe 800,000 at a push that has to be exported as well.
Yeah.
At the moment, it's pricing extremely well. The growers are getting a good value for that that canola. But at the moment, it's probably not necessarily hitting the European pricing points, but it's not all that far off. And so, yeah, we can price in, I think, quite easily into UK and Europe.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, we're going to We're going to need it. I mean, from a European scale, we're going to be importing 5.5-6 million tons of oilseed rape and canola again this season. You know, the Ukraine crop is slightly lower than what we would have hoped because they've had some dodgy yields. And so, you know, we've got to aim for as much Canadian as we can bring in, but obviously there's more GM over there, so that causes restrictions on what we can do with that. So kind of Australia and the non-GM side of Australia, if it prices in, seems to be the most viable option for the second half of the season.
Well, I feel like globally, the only large supply, apart from Europe, of non-GM canola is actually Australia, really. Like, what is it in Canada? 95% GM, if not,
yep.
If not more, probably. And, you know, Europe's been an important market for barley for a long time, especially, you know, most barley is generally sold in Australia under the RED, or the Renewable Energy Directive for biofuel in Europe. The view is that that gets a premium by selling it into Europe. So I think it's nigh on destined for it. The other question mark at the moment is Chinese demand. And with them still having issues around Canada, with their sort of political issues around their CEO of, what's his name? Huawei. Whether they're going to be looking for a bit more of Australian sort of canola as well. So I think it's interesting. This is the reason why I got into commodities in the first place, or got interested in it, is how quickly things change.
Yeah,
like one day you're sort of looking at, you know, the market and saying, well, you know, that canola's going to the price into Europe or Bangladesh or China, and the next week it's going into Liverpool.
Yeah,
and trade flows just change.
Yeah, it's just what, you know, I think the best thing about a lot of like the global commodity markets is it all is still rational and just driven by a price. And, you know, people will just buy on whatever the best price is. You know, it throws up some advantages, but also some risks. And I guess that's the point, you know, the point of kind of, you know, having these conversations and with some of the other guys that we've got on the podcast today is that, you know, from a UK perspective, we're going to be going into a very different growing season where we've had a wheat crop that is, you know, 35% down on what it was last year. You know, a barley crop, which is pretty huge in historical context, and a rapeseed crop that is, you know, a good 700,000 tons, you know, 40% lower than it was last year. It's such an odd season that it means from a grower's perspective, what defines their price and what drives their price is going to be completely different depending on which crop they're looking at from an import and export perspective. And it's almost flipped what we thought the Brexit side of things would be, you know, worrying a year, 18 months ago about export tariffs to suddenly panicking about the ability to import high grade milling wheat into the country. And if we've got the capability to do that, it's something you never thought would be possible. So,
and it is interesting because we, like from an Australian point of view, we're probably sitting on what would be considered an almost perfect year. Like I'm talking, if there's Australians listening, there'll be somebody saying, oh, but I've not got a good crop. But holistically, yeah. You've got good production for the most part. And we've got, because of the moves in overseas pricing, we've got pretty what are considered to be that psychological barrier of above $300 a ton wheat for the most part. Basis, so our premium discount over futures is low. But at the end of the day, we're getting large volumes with a profitable number. And everyone's pretty confident going forward. And then we've got a La Nina forming, which then points towards, if we look, we've done some data analysis looking back 100 years, and you tend to find that when there's a La Nina formed, we tend to have the largest amount of rainfall for that sort of 10-year period. And yields tend to go up during a La Nina. But then you look conversely, the US tends to have that sort of drier southern regions, which tends to impact upon sort of corn yields. So, you know, I like to be a bit quietly confident about not just this year, but potentially next year. Because if we get this good wet summer season, once it's been harvested, it can stop raining in November, but then it can start again in January. Then we get the subsoil moisture to plant next year's crop. And I think one of the things that I've learned being here 10 years is that the water use efficiency in Australia is extremely good and extremely efficient, in that not a drop is wasted. And we can produce crops now or a rainfall that would make British farmers cry.
Yeah, it's a completely different world, isn't it?
So it's just remarkable. Like the first time I visited a paddock, I found actually a picture of it on my Facebook memories, and it just looks like beach sand with a couple of little sprouts, wheat crop coming out of it. You know, they should have a warning for anyone who's British who looks at a crop to say it's not what you're used to.
Yes. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? From a sort of British point of view, you know, we've got such a, and like Australia, such a sort of unique growing system that you can't compare it to anything else, can you? But it shows the sort of the brilliant side of that, you know, that domestic nature of the commodity market that you're able to shift and create and still make it profitable in that kind of environment as well. That's the thing. That's the best thing about it.
Well, to give you an example, what's the average year yield for wheat in the UK this year?
This year, pretty poor. This year, probably about 7.2 tonnes a hectare compared to sort of the normal five-year average of around 8.5.
So our record crop in 2016 was 2.6 tonnes to the hectare. So in the last couple of years, we've been on some areas, you know, Queensland, 1 tonne to the hectare.
Yeah. It's crazy, isn't it?
Just remarkable. But scale.
Yeah, you know, and that's the difference, isn't it?
You know, you were talking sort of 12 million hectares.
Yeah. So. Yeah, whereas we're kind of worrying about, are we 1.8 million or 1.9 million for 21 crop, that kind of thing. That's the difference. It comes down to efficiency and what you've got to use, isn't it, really? That's the beauty of it. And what, you know, the cost to make it profitable for the growers, that's the key thing.
Exactly.
Right, Andrew, thank you. And we'll wrap it up there. And I'll say thank you for your time and thank you for taking part. It's been great to speak to you and to learn about what's going on in Australia. And we wish you well for the La Nina and hope you don't end up with as much rain as we got last October and washes you out completely. Hopefully just a little bit less than that and you'll be good.
Hopefully not. And thanks for having me. And I do enjoy your updates on email. So I'm signed up to them. So thanks very much for all your work.
And finally, Andrei Sizov, Managing Director of Sovicon, and we'll be discussing the importance of Russia on the global wheat market and how they'll impact the UK and world prices going forwards. I'm here with Andrei Sizov, who's Managing Director of Sovicon, an analyst company based in Russia, focusing on Black Sea markets. Andrei, thank you for joining us. Would you just like to say hello and introduce yourself quickly and what you do?
I'm with Sovicon. I've been working for this firm for more than 20 years, and I've been covering agricultural markets with special focus on the Black Sea for more than 20 years. At least in recent years, we have been the most accurate forecasters of the Russian wheat crop. For example, this year and right now, consensus about the Russian wheat crop is around 82, 84 million tons. And whole this year, 2020, we have been in around 80, 84 million tons range for the new crop. While actually several months ago, the market was talking around 75 million tons or 73 million tons. And now we're 10 million above that right now.
So what do you think that means for going further forwards and for sort of export forecasts for this year? Because obviously there's been a lot of talk of an increase in Russian exports. There's been a lot of business that's been done in September. I guess we're expecting that to continue for the rest of the season.
It's running more or less in line with expectations. Actually, the start was a bit sluggish. The July exports were relatively weak. If you talk about wheat, it was around 3 point something. And actually, many were expecting that it would be higher. But in August, things began to speed up. And it looks like in September, we don't have the final data at this stage, but it's going to be wheat exports are going to be around 5 million tons, which is a new record high for Russia. Actually, we expect that experts will continue to run at such record high pace, at least in October, and probably they would start to slow down in November, December, January for two reasons, I think. One is a typical seasonal pattern. Things begin to slow down around New Year, and in Russia and Black Sea, it's a long story because it's starts somewhere around mid-December and ends around mid-January. And actually, no one does anything at that time. That's one reason. A more specific reason for this season, we have started, as you probably know, we have started and whole world wheat market is relatively high right now. If you talk about Black Sea, it's around $235 per ton for 12.5 protein wheat deep sea port. Around a year ago, it was roughly $30-$40 lower than that. So we started pretty high, and farmers, they like record high ruble prices right now. And if FOB price, it would decline even slightly, it would take time for domestic market to adjust to those lower FOB values. And I think that could be one of the reasons why exports would slow down in next months. And if we talk about 2021, there's obviously a big threat for Black Sea exports, Russian exports. It's bumper Australian crop, because in recent years, Southeastern Asia became a pretty important destination for both Russia and Ukraine, Indonesia, Philippines, Vietnam. And in all those markets, we're likely to compete pretty, competition going to be pretty tough with Australia in 2021.
So do you think that will put some pressure on Russian prices and sort of global export markets as we sort of head out of this winter and that Australian crop starts coming online into those markets?
Yeah, yeah. It's Australia. They could harvest up to 30 million tons next crop. And yes, the competition going to be pretty tough. There are some problems in Argentina, obviously, but it's just a few million tons below the previous year. So it's not a game changer. While Australian crop indeed could be a game changer, they had very nice rains just in recent months and weeks. And they're starting to harvest a good crop, and competition going to be pretty tough.
Yeah, obviously it's been very dry in Australia for the past 3 or 4 years, and that is something that we're seeing in Russia at the moment, isn't it? For the winter crop planting, that it's been very dry, and the forecast that I saw this morning for the next 10 days or so still looks like there's not a lot of rainfall. But farmers have been planting pretty rapidly, haven't they? So you're expecting another sort of record area going in the ground at the moment, you would think.
Yes, so about the planting pace, it's Ukraine is substantially behind the previous year, but they still have some time and they already had rains during the previous week. So Ukraine crops, there are no big issues with Ukrainian winter wheat crop. But as for Russia, yes, it's becoming a big issue. But, you know, Russia is a huge country. You have South here, Center here, Volga Valley here. So those are three key winter wheat regions. So Volga Valley, it's more or less okay. South, it was very dry. South of Russia, major growing and export region. It was very dry in previous months, and weeks. Last week, actually, right now, I'm in the south of Russia. Last week, we had some rains here. Not enough, but at least there's something in parts of Kuban and Stavropol. So things improved a little bit. They're not ideal, very far from ideal, but improved a little bit. But center of Russia, central Black Earth, that's number two growing and export region. Things are very dry there, especially southern part of the center. And yes, there are no forecasts next 2 weeks. And looks like the region will remain dry. And Russian winter wheat is likely to enter this winter in a worst shape for many years. So I think it's obviously the crop is not being done right now, but we do understand, and especially that part of Russia I've talked about, a center of Russia, southern part of the center of Russia is going to be dry, and actually the crop could just, plants could just fail in that region. It's very likely that it could be lost.
So what would happen if that crop is lost? Would that just get planted with spring crops instead, or would there be another crop that would go in the ground in its place?
It depends on particular farm. I think some probably would plant spring wheat. Some could plant oil seeds because, you know, we have a record high ruble prices right now for beginning of the season for grain, for wheat specifically. But for sunflower, which is a pretty big number two cash crop in Russia and Ukraine, for sunflower prices are record ones. And I think in many cases, farmers would prefer to plant sunflower, for example, instead of winter wheat. So it's not necessarily spring wheat instead of winter wheat. I think there's a good chance they would prefer to plant oil seeds and sunflower specifically.
So I suppose over the next few months, you've probably got two different elements to the markets, that you might have a lot of export competition from Australia trying to push the market lower. But at the same time, you might have a little bit of uncertainty over the condition of the crop that could, you know, offer a little bit of support to new crop prices as well. And that's going to be the balance between those would be the one to look out for.
Yes, if we look at the whole season, yes, that's correct. But farmers, they think in a different way. In Russia, they don't sell forward typically. They don't hedge. So basically what they do, they just sell the crops when they need cash or they need to free up the storage and wait till they need to sell it again or till the new crop arrives. This is what they do typically.
Cool. Okay. So just sort of have a bit of a different question, more from, I guess, kind of like an export point of view and maybe sort of like a more of a sort of political point of view. We see a lot of stories coming into the global market about export restrictions being placed on Russia, especially in that January through to June 21 period. How much of that is sort of fundamental in sort of the export availability, and how much of it is more of a political game that's being played? Should we be concerned about that at this point?
Yes, if you're buying wheat, if you're trading wheat, if you're importing wheat, you should definitely watch this story. Actually, we predicted the latest restrictions, export restrictions, which happened in April, June 2020. We predicted them almost a year ago. So yes, this story remains on the agenda. There's a very high chance that Ministry of Agriculture will propose to limit exports, to introduce an export quota for January-June 2021. They really like this idea. And actually, they wanted to introduce quotas at the beginning of this year, 2020. But it wasn't approved by another ministry, Ministry of Economic Development, which also should approve such proposal. It wasn't approved, but later, amid all the COVID story, they succeeded and introduced those quotas. And they said it was a very good and successful case. Personally, I don't agree, but they said that. And they also said we want to introduce to make those quotas permanent for every season, every second half of the season, January, June. They want to introduce some kind of restrictions because they have, strange to say the least, explanation, because they don't believe in supply and demand forces. And they say the demand for Russian wheat is extremely high. And if we don't limit exports, we could end up with zero wheat, zero grain in the country. So they keep saying that. Expect to see more details in forthcoming few weeks, probably around mid-October. That's a bad thing for traders and farmers. The good part of the story is that we expect that those restrictions should be close to actual exportable surplus because Minister of personally, Vladimir Putin does like all that grain export story. And I don't think that Minister of Agriculture will dare to upset Mr. Putin, because he always loves to talk about Russian export success. It's one part of the story, and as one that it's still those proposed quotas still needed to be approved by Ministry of Economy, as I mentioned earlier. For example, in the beginning of the 2020, they disapproved that it wasn't approved by them and they couldn't introduce it. There is an important obstacle to introduce any quotas because Russia is a member of WTO. And according to its obligations, it can't introduce any export quotas if there is no emergency. For example, if all grain is eaten by locusts or something like that, we can do that. But if we talk about the country which is the largest wheat world exporter, it's kind of strange to introduce any permanent quotas. And they also got the point. So I still hope I'm 95% sure that Ministry of Agriculture won't produce quota, but I still hope that it won't approve by Ministry of Economy.
Okay. I suppose that kind of is met on the other side by a lot of importers around the world that are very conscious about food security, aren't they? And there's a lot of countries that are trying to, you know, purchase a lot of wheat. And I think that's been a supportive factor over the last few weeks, especially given the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. A lot of these countries are very sort of food secure. And I suppose you know, that probably places Russia's importance in the world wheat market higher points, because with the volume of exports you're doing and the demand, you know, it means that the market is going to react more and more to any stories that come out about Russia. So it's really useful to get more information on what's going on and kind of get a bit more detail. So thank you for that. And I'd like to sort of finish on a positive note, because for a lot of people, 2020 has been a bit of a crap year, to say the least. What would be your one positive story that you would have for the grain markets and from a Russian grain market at the moment? What's kind of the good news that's happening at the moment?
With current drought and all those talks about exit restriction, it's hard to find. It's not easy to find a really positive story. But if we look at, so let's focus on good things. So if we look at supply and demand in Russia, we still have plenty of wheat. That's one point. Farmers need to sell it sooner or later, and I think they would be forced to sell it if they don't want to see FOB to sell it when FOB won't be below $200 per ton. So Minister of Agriculture, I think if they try to push any restrictions, they will try to do something more or less reasonable. Because, for example, in the previous season, their quota was actually close, very close to exportable surplus, which was calculated by us independently, 7 million tons. So hopefully, Russia won't be won't bring any bad news to the world market, to the world wheat market this year and next year, and would be a reasonable supplier of the wheat to the rest of the world, especially to the countries which could badly need it.
Great. Thank you. Andre, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. It's been really interesting getting all of the detail and all of the information on what's going on with Russia. And thank you for everything. And I hope that the rest of the year and the rest of the growing season is good from your point of view and good from a Russian point of view.
Yeah. Thank you, David. Thanks.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, leave a review to help other people find the show. It really does help us to appear in the podcast rankings and means we can reach more people.
That's just about it for this month's episode. A big thank you to all my guests, to Rob, Ben, Andrew, and Andre for joining me. Now, while this is the last day of the Grain Market Outlook Week, don't worry if you've missed any of our webinars. They will all be made available via the AHDB website. Just visit ahdb.org.uk/serials webinars to hear expert analysis on wheat, barley, and oilseed markets. You can also watch our annual Market Outlook webinar covering both global and domestic issues for the 2020-21 season. You can find the latest up-to-date information on cereals and oilseeds markets by visiting ahdb.org.uk/cereals-oilseeds-markets. Scroll to the bottom of the page and you'll be able to sign up to all of our regular updates, and they'll be sent straight to your inbox. Now, during this difficult time, AHDB is committed to supporting levy payers with the challenges they may face as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. We have a dedicated webpage filled with resources and information. Please visit ahdb.org.uk/coronavirus. I'm David Udall. Thank you very much for listening.